Let me tell you a fictional story. A politician is canvassing for votes and knocks on the door of a house in his constituency. Two women come to the door and he asks them what issues they're bearing in mind as they consider who to vote for in the forthcoming general election. They say they want to know what candidates will do to support same-sex marriage. He tells them, as politely as he's able, that in fact he's not in good conscience able to support same-sex marriage in the way they'd like him to, because he is a Christian, and he believes the Bible when it says that the God-given institution of marriage is to be between a man and a woman. They take offence. They tell the press. The press announces that the politician is a bigot, and the politician is obliged to resign. That fictional story may remind you of the true story of Jim Wells, you might have seen in the papers, the Northern Ireland health minister, who resigned last week after a conversation with a lesbian couple while out canvassing. Now, I don't know all the details of Mr. Wells' story. Perhaps there is more going on there than I know about. So my version isn't a true story, but the example of Jim Wells shows that it is a far from unrealistic story. If we are not quite there, we are very nearly at the point where it is impossible for someone holding biblical views on homosexual practice to hold public office. Perhaps we think, well, that's all right for me, I'll just sort of stay out of politics, but it will be teachers next, and then it will be police officers, and then it will be anyone working in the public sector. People in this room will have to choose between keeping their job by compromising their biblical values or losing their job by maintaining their biblical values. For the original recipients of this letter to the Hebrews, it seems that that sort of white heat of persecution is behind them. For Christians in the UK today, it seems that such persecution is ahead. But that puts us in a similar position. Not in the fires right now, but not far away. And just facing the ordinary disappointments of life and the low-key mockery from non-Christians that comes from not yet being in heaven. Our writer says to the Hebrews, you persevered when the heat was really on. It would be silly to give up now when things have cooled a little just because you haven't made it to heaven yet. He says to us, you want to persevere when the heat is really on, don't you? Well, practice enduring these smaller challenges that life is throwing at you now. What is the answer to enduring in the face of opposition? Well, it is having not just faith, but biblical faith. Last week in the first part of chapter 11, we saw Old Testament believers illustrating four principles of biblical faith. Biblical faith focuses on the future. It values the verbal over the visible. It pleases God, and it leads to obedience. And this week you'll be thrilled to hear we've got four more. So, biblical faith perseveres to the end. It alienates from the world. It endures opposition. And it unites with the church. Here is the first. Biblical faith perseveres to the end. This is sort of verses 13 to 22, although really all over the chapter. So look at verse 13 with me of chapter 11. Verse 13. These Old Testament believers all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar. A death makes a mockery of most people's philosophies of life, but not of biblical faith. If my life is governed by the ambition to be prime minister, and I haven't achieved that before I die, I've failed. If my ambition is to be wealthy, and I'm not wealthy by the time I die, I've failed. Death is literally the deadline for meeting those kinds of, achieving those kinds of ambitions. And so the 95-year-old man who never leaves the house, but still clings to the ambition to be prime minister, is laughable. And the woman dying in a hospital bed who used her last breath to ask someone to buy her a lottery ticket is laughable and sad. You give up that kind of philosophy of life in the face of death. But if my life is governed by the ambition to live in the new creation with God. Death, painful as it may be, is a step towards success. And so biblical faith doesn't give up in the face of death. It perseveres to the end. That is why there is a list of old men in verses 20 to 22. Look at them with me. Verse 20, by faith Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. Genesis 27 says that happened when Isaac was old. By faith Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. Staff as in stick, not staff as employees there. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. Don't write the details of those little vignettes. You can look them up in Genesis later if you like. The big point is this. Because biblical faith is focused primarily on the future, on life in the new creation, a life that can only be accessed through death unless Jesus returns first, biblical faith doesn't give up in the face of death. It continues to look forward, as it always has. We don't have time to look at the example of Abraham in verses 17 to 19, but part of the point of those verses is the same thing. Abraham was prepared to obey God's command to sacrifice his son Isaac, because he knew that death wasn't the end. Now, death remains a terrible thing. It is no cozy friend. That ghastly poem that people sometimes have at funerals, death is nothing at all, makes my skin crawl. What nonsense. Death is not nothing at all. It is our enemy. But because of Jesus' death and resurrection, it is for Christians a defeated enemy. So while we may fear the manner of dying, Christians need not fear death itself. If we live for anything in this life, death will make a mockery of our philosophy of life. But if we live for the new creation, death is in one sense all part of the plan. So let me ask you, do you have a philosophy of life that takes account of death? If you are not yet living for Jesus, what are you living for? Because you will die. Is your ambition one that death can really help you to achieve, as it is for the Christian? Or is your ambition one that death makes a mockery of? If you are following Jesus, press on. Biblical faith perseveres to the end. Second principle, biblical faith alienates from the world. This is verses sort of 13 to 16 and 24 to 26. So verse 13 again. These Old Testament believers all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they're seeking a homeland. If they'd been thinking of that land from which they'd gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. Believers acknowledge that they are strangers and exiles on earth. That word acknowledge is a very strong word. I mean, to confess, it's actually the same word that's used back in chapter 4 and chapter 10 of Hebrews to refer to the confession of faith in Jesus. It's part of the same thing. We confess. Being a Christian means confessing means declaring that Jesus is my king and that therefore my home is with him in his kingdom, in the better country, in the city that God is preparing, in the new creation, in heaven, and that therefore this world is not my home and I am a stranger and an exile here. Dual citizenship is not an option for the Christian. To get citizenship in heaven, I must actively renounce citizenship on earth. That is why biblical faith alienates from the world. So many of us want to live with a foot in both camps, to get to go to heaven when we die, but right now, just to live like those around us, with the same hopes and dreams and ambitions as those around us, and therefore approved by those around us. Perhaps it shows up most clearly in people's ambitions for their children. Which thrills our hearts more? That they pass another exam and so become better equipped to live as a citizen of Tunbridge Wells? or that they get into the habit of reading their Bibles every morning, and so become better equipped to live as a citizen of heaven. That they get a girlfriend, she's not a Christian, but she's so lovely, and so demonstrate they're going to get along okay in this world. Or they break up with the non-Christian girlfriend because she's not helping them to follow Jesus, and so demonstrate they're going to get along okay in the world to come. We can't have dual citizenship. Moses discovered this. Look at verse 24 with me. Verse 24, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. The reproach of Christ is a strange expression, but remember that Christ just means a sort of anointed or chosen. I don't think it's really talking about Jesus particularly. I think the expression means the world's disapproval that you get when you live as part of God's chosen people. Moses was brought up and educated with the Egyptians, but to his career's advisors' astonishment and displeasure, he opted out of the riches and pleasures of that world and put away his degree certificate from the University of Cairo in the back of the drawer somewhere in order to take on slave status, serving God's people and facing the disapproval and suffering that they were facing. You give your hard-earned savings to get your son through years and years of medical school. He works very hard, passes his exams, a well-paid, well-respected, useful career as a pediatrician, say, beckons. And he rings you one day and says, I've been helping lead some Bible studies at church and leading a college CU, and my tutors at college and most of my mates think I've gone mad, but I think that for me, serving Jesus might mean going into possibly poorly paid, increasingly unrespectable full-time ministry. Is your first reaction, what a waste? Or is it, how wonderful? That is not my story, in case you're wondering. I really had no prospects when the Church of England very generously agreed to take me on as some kind of charity case. Following Jesus won't mean full-time ministry for most people, but it will always mean the surprise, disappointment, and disapproval of the world around us at some of our decisions, because we are no longer living for the things that they care about. We are citizens of a different country. And so biblical faith alienates from the world. Third principle, biblical faith endures opposition. Verses 23 to 38. This is the new note in chapter 11 from verse 23 onwards. Christians face all the same kinds of difficulties in life as everybody else, sadness and sickness and suffering. But when we renounce our citizenship in this world in order to take up citizenship in the new creation, that brings in addition a particular sort of opposition from the old country. It's the kind of opposition that today costs Christian politicians their jobs and tomorrow may cost us our jobs. Biblical faith expects such opposition and it endures it. Sometimes God enables us to endure opposition by giving us short-term victory over it, victory in this life. And that's what happens to the Old Testament believers in verses 32 to the beginning of 35. Again, don't worry about the details of these people's stories, but look with me at verse 32. What more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. God enabled these believers to endure opposition of various kinds by giving them short-term victory over it, as he sometimes does. But sometimes God enables believers to endure opposition despite short-term defeat in this world. That is what happens to the next list of believers. So picking up again in the middle of verse 35. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. These believers' lives didn't go so well in this world. God allowed them to face defeat in the short term from the opposition. But their biblical faith endured despite that. Christians, I think, love most of God's promises. But I suspect there are one or two that we don't even believe. God promises this in 2 Timothy. All who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. Doesn't mean we'll face a constant barrage of abuse from every non-Christian we meet all the time, clearly. But we must expect active opposition at some point. If I never face such opposition, it is worth at least asking myself the question, can the world around me tell that I am not living for the things they are living for? I find that personally rather challenging to my largely opposition-free Tunbridge Wells middle-class lifestyle and expectations. I suspect I need to do something about it. Biblical faith expects opposition and it endures opposition, whether God gives short-term victory or short-term defeat. In verse 34, some escape the sword. In verse 37, some are killed with the sword. We must praise God for short-term victories when tribunals find in favour of unfairly dismissed Christians, for example. But we mustn't get triumphalist, as though if we vote for the right people and sign the right petitions, the opposition will stop. It won't. The victory and vindication that we look for is long-term in the new creation. In verse 33, some of these short-term victors are described as having obtained promises, particular things that God had promised for particular people. But in verse 39, it said that none of them received what was promised, and not the big thing that they were looking forward to. There are many little victories in this life. There are lots of wonderful things to enjoy. God blesses us in a million ways here and now, and we rejoice in those things. But we continue to focus on the future, on the great victory that will be ours in the new creation, a victory that can be ours, even if we have to die for our faith. We expect opposition, but biblical faith endures opposition. Fourth and last principle, biblical faith unites with the church from verses 39 and 40. Verses 39 and 40 are frankly a bit odd, but there must be a reason why God has put them in the Bible, so let's at least read them. Verse 39, and all these Old Testament believers, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. Let me give you my best guess as to what those verses mean, and if you know better, come and tell me afterwards. To be made perfect in the book of Hebrews means something like getting the full package of blessings that God promises to those who trust him. Forgiveness, the assurance of forgiveness, and life in the new creation. Old Testament believers were forgiven and had a genuine relationship with God because they took God at his word when he said that those things were available. But because they lived before Jesus, they didn't have the full package. And for example, they didn't have the same assurance of forgiveness that New Testament believers have. It was Jesus' death that would pay the price for their sins in exactly the same way as it has paid the price for ours. But because they didn't know about it, they couldn't get assurance of their forgiveness by looking back at it. These verses are saying that God deliberately delayed giving Old Testament believers that full package of blessings so that they'd only get it in unity with New Testament believers like you and me. It's like not getting out the birthday cake until your last guests have arrived at the party. It might be a bit annoying for those who arrived on time, but it gives the party a sense of sort of togetherness. God's plan is for each believer, whatever point of history they live in, to feel now that sense of unity across the ages that comes from worshipping Jesus. earlier in our service, we said the Apostles' Creed together. I wonder if you've ever wondered what the communion of the saints is and whether you really do believe it. You say it so clearly. I think that that doctrine is what this verse is teaching. There is a communion of saints that all believers from across the ages are united in Jesus. Why does the writer include that in this passage? Might not sound very concrete and practical to us, but he thinks that it will help us to keep going with Jesus if we just feel that sense of privilege and that sense of historical connectedness. So let's feel it. Biblical faith may alienate us from the world around us, but it unites us to God's people from across the world and from every era, past, present, and future. Biblical faith unites with the church. We need to close by glancing again at the verses we're going to look at properly next week. That is the author's conclusion to chapter 11. It has to be ours. So look with me at chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. We've seen at least 8 principles of faith in chapter 11. Biblical faith focuses on the future. It values the verbal over the visible. It pleases God. It leads to obedience. Biblical faith perseveres to the end. It alienates from the world. It endures opposition. It unites with the church. We've seen Old Testament believers illustrating those principles, and their example can help us to keep going as Christians in the face of disappointment and persecution. But if you read some of their stories in the Old Testament, you'll see that the accounts that we have here are, let's say, highly selective. We sometimes call them the heroes of faith, but just to take the examples in verse 32, Gideon and Barak were cowards, Samson slept with prostitutes, Jephthah killed his daughter, and David killed his mistress's husband. Now we're to look at their example and think, weren't those great heroes and we should try to be more like them? We're to look at their example and think, isn't God great that he gave saving faith to sinners like them and can give it to me if I'll trust in Jesus? The faith that they had and that we can have is an undeserved gift from God. But Jesus had that faith somehow innately. And so we must, above all, look to him, to put our trust in him, and to worship him, if we're not yet following Jesus. Remember how short this life is. Let me plead with you to adopt a philosophy of life that can cope with death. If we are following Jesus, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. We don't need to be knocked off course by disappointment or by opposition. Biblical faith perseveres to the end because we know our citizenship is not here, but in the new creation, along with the rest of God's church, past, present, and future. So let us look to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God.